Today is July the 17th, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at PCRadioshow.org. Our website is PCRadioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live, that's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at Hank at PCRadioshow.org. Microsoft admits weak points of Copilot Plus PCs with ARM CPUs, including driver issues, plus game and app compatibility. When it first was announced, my initial recommendation was, give it time before you adopt it, or unless you want to be a pioneer, but don't rely on this for any kind of mission critical or applications important to you. Microsoft is being refreshingly upfront about Windows 11 on ARM. Microsoft has admitted there are some shortcomings of Copilot Plus PCs that run ARM processors, which are the only type of those devices to have gone on sale so far, and outlined these weak points. Of course, there are strengths with Copilot Plus PCs that run with new Snapdragon X ARM CPUs. In the interest of balance, let's go over first Microsoft's clutch of admissions, of which there is a list of five limitations of Windows 11 ARM-based PC provided in a support FAQ that was recently published. First off, Microsoft points out that drivers for hardware, games, and apps will only work if they're designed for a Windows 11 ARM-based PC. This is a thorny one that has a knock-on effect elsewhere. Obviously, this means that you can't use peripherals or hardware that haven't had ARM drivers released, unless the device already has support built into Windows 11, that is. However, also leads to drawback number two, which is that certain games won't work. And one prominent reason for this is that they have anti-cheat drivers that haven't been coded for ARM-based PCs. These kinds of anti-cheat countermeasures are popular in competitive online games for obvious reasons. A further downside Microsoft highlights is that some antivirus apps don't work, and again, this is often wrapped up in driver issues. So three of the negative points come back to driver support, or at least they potentially do. Moving to the fourth shortcoming on Microsoft's list, this is apps that customize the Windows experience might have problems. This includes some input method editors, assistive technologies, and cloud storage apps. Finally, Microsoft notes that Windows Fax and Scan is not available on Windows 11 ARM-based machines, which is obviously much more of a niche pitfall. So in short, the main drawbacks of ARM-powered Copilot Plus devices can be summarized as follows. You may get some, inability to run with some apps, and some games won't work, and neither will some devices, due to driver problems, which may also affect some of the aforementioned games and, indeed, antivirus apps. It's good to see Microsoft being upfront about these issues, and the company has covered what we consider to be all of the main bases in terms of major drawbacks with Windows on ARM as it stands as of today. As was mentioned before, in the interest of balance, Microsoft also details the strengths of ARM-based Copilot Plus PCs, which include battery life in spades, and instant on functionality, triggering the device to come to life like a smartphone with no waiting time to speak of. What's also important to underline is that Microsoft has made some big strides with Windows on ARM, and compatibility is much more improved now, as is the ability to emulate games and run even the likes of Baldur's Gate 3 at a palatable frame rate for a non-gaming laptop. This is pretty remarkable. Actually, it's impressive by the fact that Copilot Plus PCs have had this evaluation so far. It's been found that Microsoft's battery life boasts are indeed valid and has been proven to have impressed performance of the new Surface laptop. Furthermore, the Surface Pro 11 got top marks in many reviews in which they call for the device a laptop that Apple should be worrying about. So you do need to be aware of what you're getting yourself into when you want to buy a Windows 11 on ARM, but these early Copilot Plus PCs are definitely impressive in many respects. However, those who remain on the fence can always wait for a more traditional Copilot Plus PC on standard Windows 11 with an AMD or Intel x86 mobile processor, when those respective next-gen efforts with a powerful enough NPU emerge. In the case of AMD, you won't be waiting long. Laptops with Ryzen AI 300 CPUs are expected to arrive later in the month of July, and Intel's Lunar Lake processors are further out, but still expected to debut sometime in later 2024. First, it was Japan. Now the German Navy is retiring all floppy diskettes for good. Back in January of this year, the Japanese government said it would be taking action to abandon a decade-old practice of insisting businesses must submit supplementary data on floppies or CD-ROMs. Following that, in July of this year, Japan's digital agency declared it had successfully abolished 1,034 regulations governing the use of floppy disks. Taro Kono, Japan's Minister for Digital Transformation and the head of the digital agency, announced grandly, "We have won the war on floppy diskettes on June 28th. Well, now it's reported that the German Navy is looking to follow suit and replace the floppy drives used on its four Brandenburg-class F-123 frigates with a modern emulated solution. These anti-submarine frigates were commissioned between 1994 and 1996 when floppy disks were the height of storage. Diskette 1 floppy media can store between 240,000 bytes and 1.2 megabytes depending on the version and its use in frigate data acquisition systems. Saab recently signed a contract with the German Federal Office of Bundeswehr Equipment, Information Technology and In-Service Support to deliver and fit new naval radars and fire control directors for the F-123 German frigates, including a new combat management system. The data acquisition system for which the floppy drives are used is a separate part of the upgrade process and it won't be handled by Saab. The system is an essential part of controlling the actual ship functions of a frigate. Although it has nothing to do with the weapon systems, it is important for controlling the drive or power generation because the operating parameters have to be recorded. In order to avoid replacing the entire measuring technology, the Navy has the choice of leaving the existing storage media in place or finding an emulation replacement that acts as if it were a floppy disk drive. They are now currently looking for a supplier for this option. The persistence of floppy disk use highlights the challenge of modernizing legacy systems in critical operations. While new technologies offer vast improvements, the cost and complexity of overhauling entrenched systems can often be prohibitive. Emulation solutions provide a middle ground, allowing for incremental updates without the need for extensive hardware changes. Is Windows 11's built-in security enough to protect your PC? Windows 11, Microsoft's latest operating system, comes with a suite of built-in security features, but in an era of increasingly sophisticated cyber threats, many users wonder if these native protections are enough. Windows 11 includes several security enhancements over its predecessors. Microsoft Defender Antivirus, a built-in antivirus solution that provides real-time protection against malware, viruses, and other threats. It uses cloud-based intelligence to detect emerging threats. There is also Secured Core PCs, where the hardware-based security features like TPM 2.0, Secure Boot, and Virtualization-Based Security, that's VBS, protect against firmware-level attacks. Included in Windows 11 is Smart Screen, which warns users when they attempt to visit malicious websites or download suspicious files. Then there's Firewall, monitors network traffic and blocks unauthorized access to your PC. These features offer a strong foundation, but are they sufficient on their own? While Microsoft Defender is a capable antivirus solution, it may not always catch the latest and most sophisticated threat. Third-party antivirus programs often employ more advanced detection methods and leverage larger threat databases to identify these emerging threats. Additionally, many antivirus suites go beyond basic malware defense and offer a variety of extra features that can enhance your overall security posture. These features can include VPNs for secure encrypted browsing, password managers to help you create and manage strong passwords for all your online accounts, and identity theft protection to monitor for breaches of your personal information. Independent testing labs consistently rank antivirus products ahead of Microsoft Defender in threat detection capabilities. Finally, for users managing multiple devices across a household or business, a unified antivirus solution can offer significant advantages in terms of centralized management and ensuring comprehensive protection for all devices. If you decide to enhance Windows 11 security with additional antivirus, consider these factors. 1. Malware detection rates. One of the most important factors in selecting an antivirus is its ability to detect and block malware. 2. Performance impact. Some antivirus programs can slow down your PC. Look for lightweight options that provide protection without hogging valuable resources. 3. Compatibility. Ensure the antivirus is designed for Windows 11 and doesn't conflict with built-in security features. Then there's the issue of customer support. If you run into issues with your antivirus, having reliable support is crucial. And finally, of course, price. While free antivirus exists, paid versions generally offer more comprehensive protection and features. Antivirus is just one layer of defense. To fully safeguard your Windows 11 computer, experts advise the following. Keeping software updated. Install updates for Windows and all your apps to patch security holes. Use strong passwords. Employ unique, complex passwords and enable two-factor authentication when available. Be cautious online. Avoid clicking suspicious links, downloading unknown files, or giving out personal information. And of course, my favorite subject, backing up your data. Regularly backing up important files to an external drive or cloud storage to protect against ransomware and other data loss. While Windows 11 includes strong built-in protections, most cybersecurity experts agree that adding a reputable third-party antivirus provides the most comprehensive security. However, antivirus is just part of a larger strategy that should include smart computing habits and multi-layered defenses. Combining the right tools and practices can significantly reduce your risk and allow you to enjoy greater peace of mind on Windows 11. Of course, my message on safeguarding what you have is back up regularly.
Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and how they intertwine. And one of the big things that I'm going to be talking about here is loss of revenue, loss of profit. And this is something that is really applying to the major corporations around the world, specifically the Global 2000. But a lot of this same idea, a lot of this same concept trickles down. It's still going to apply to even medium companies, small companies. And it all has to do with one big thing that we've actually been fighting for a very long time. And that is IT downtime. Now, let me start off by defining what IT downtime is. That's where you have a computer. Your individual computer is down. That's a little minor drop in the bucket. Then we start talking about a major server going down, or the key programs that your company relies on. Now, out of this study, and I'm going to admit right off the bat, or highlight rather, that this is dropped out by a study that is was done by Splunk. Now, Splunk is, of course, providing a self-serving study. They're looking into sort of the reasons why people need to utilize their services. Their services have been to be in regards to logging and a lot of tracking of the information that's going in between servers so that they can figure out what is causing IT downtime. All right. That having been said, they interviewed a bunch of CIOs. These are chief information officers and chief security officers, CSOs. And they said, hey, what is really costing you IT downtime? How much is IT downtime costing you? And the Global 2000 folks, they put all of those numbers together and they said, you guys are losing an average of $200 million apiece. I want you to think about this. A Fortune 500 company losing $100 million due to IT downtime, or $200 million. Now, this is spread out in a number of different directions. But the big, huge headline says that is hitting profit by 9%. I want you to think about that. 9% of the profit is lost to this IT downtime. And of course, I remember one of my bosses way back years ago. He said, IT just costs money. You know, we would be better off if we just didn't have servers. Well, of course, we have to have technology. That's the only way we can keep up with all of our competitors. But since we can't cut out IT, we have to look at what is causing these bits and pieces of downtime. Of course, the big place everybody starts looking at is what is ransomware? What is malware? What are all of these different data extortion payouts that we're doing? Now, those large enterprises, Global 2000, they were spending roughly $19 million on that. $19 million is a big chunk of change. When you start counting that across all of the different companies, that racks up really quick. Again, that's an average of $19 million. An average budget for them, $13.5 million. What? Yeah, that's right. They are not thinking about all of these different things and not budgeting enough for all of this downtime. But now there are other things that also eat into that cost of downtime. $49 million of that estimated $200 million average, again, that was lost revenue. That was a matter of, we've got various customers that we cannot provide services to. We can't sell our widgets, whatever it is, to our customers, and we lost all of those sales, and we may not recoup those losses. Now, other different big costs that came into that were regulatory fines. You know, the governments around the world will fine companies if they get hit by downtime that is avoidable, and there's a lot of stuff that's built into that. So there are various fines that you can have levied against you if you have your services go down. There are also various service level agreements. So I have a contract with my internet service provider. And if my internet service provider goes down for longer than an hour, they owe me some money back. If they go down for more than a day, they owe me a lot of money back as far as how little I pay them. But they owe that to all of the customers. I want you to think about that. If you have a day-long outage, by the way, you can go to your internet service provider and say, hey, I was down for a day. I'd like some kind of recompense for that. And they will provide that. There are also legal costs in that big, huge, big picture of $15 million. And that's because your servers were down. A lot of different folks out there really focus on the downtime that's caused by the traditional IT issues. We're talking about dealing with an actual server failure. We're dealing with software that breaks and different code releases that have problems in them. But they don't really think about a lot of that cybersecurity side. And I think that's really the biggest place we all need to be focusing on. This is something that every company should be spending more time and energy beating back the scammers, the bad guys, training their employees. But above all, looking for other ways, looking for what were the key reasons why we had problems with our computers in the past year, and how do we keep those problems from occurring again? This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin.
What are trusted certificates for computer programs? Trusted certificates play a crucial role in enabling secure communication and interactions for computer programs. Trusted certificates issued by a certificate authority are essential for establishing trust between computer programs and remote servers. When a program attempts to validate and determine if it can trust a certificate, it follows a chain of trust up to a known authority or the ultimate parent or root certificate. These certificates are fundamental for secure communication, as they authenticate a computer to another by issuing a digital certificate. This process ensures that secure connections can be established without encountering warnings or errors when accessing resources. Trusted certificates are part of a chain of trust that links the N-entity certificate. This chain ensures that the N-entity certificate can be trusted by verifying its lineage back to a trusted root. Trusted certificates are a fundamental component of a trusted public key infrastructure. They provide security, scalability, and compliance with certificate authority standards, ensuring the overall trustworthiness of the public key infrastructure. Trusted certificates are required for several reasons. Trusted certificates issued by a certificate authority ensure the security and integrity of data transmitted over the Internet. They enable secure communication by encrypting data and verifying the identity of the parties involved. Browsers come with built-in lists of trusted certificate providers, and when a website presents a certificate signed by a trusted certificate authority, it establishes trust between the website and the user's browser. This trust is essential for secure online transactions and interactions. In the case of legal and regulatory compliance, there are many uses of digital certificates, such as for legally binding the digital signatures are linked to local law, regulations, and accreditation schemes for certificate authorities. Therefore, trusted certificates are essential for compliance with legal and regulatory requirements. Trusted certificates are part of a chain of trust that links the N-entity certificate to a trusted root certificate. This chain ensures that the N-entity certificate can be trusted by verifying its lineage back to a trusted root.
public key infrastructure, trust certificates are a fundamental component of a public key infrastructure. They provide security, scalability, and compliance with certificate authority standards, ensuring the overall trustworthiness of the public key infrastructure. Trusted certificates are essential for running programs that require secure communication over the Internet. Programs that communicate over HTTPS, such as web browsers, require trusted certificates to establish secure connections without encountering security warnings or errors. How do programs get trusted certificates? To run programs that require trusted certificates, the process typically involves ensuring that the necessary certificates are available and trusted by the system. Here's how programs obtain trusted certificates to run securely. There are default trusted root certification authorities. Operating systems like Windows come with a default set of public certification authorities that have met the requirements of the default set of trusted certification authorities and even install their own private certificate certification authority for verifying software. However, it's important to note that a private certificate authority is unlikely to be trusted outside the network environment. In Windows, a publisher is trusted only if its certificate is installed in the Trusted Publisher's Certificate Store. This means that a user or administrator must decide whether to install or run an application on a case-by-case basis based on their knowledge of the software publisher and application. In Windows, administrators can manage and configure trusted root certificates to prevent other users in the domain from configuring their own set. This involves adding certificates to the Trusted Root Certification Authority Store for a local computer using the Microsoft Management Control and Certificate Snap-in. Are trusted certificates needed to run macOS and Linux programs? Yes. Trusted certificates are indeed required to run programs on both macOS and Linux. These certificates establish a chain of trust that verifies other certificates signed by the trusted roots, enabling secure connections to web servers and other secure communication channels. When IT administrators create configuration profiles for macOS, these trusted root certificates don't need to be included, as they are already part of the system's trust store. Similarly, on Linux, adding trusted root certificates to the system trust store ensures that all system tools trust websites that use the added certificate certification authority. However, it is important to note that this may not affect web browsers like Firefox and Chrome, as they have their own separate certificate stores. Trusted certificates are essential for running programs on macOS and Linux, as they establish the necessary trust for secure communication over the Internet. New Chrome security rules for websites have until November the 1st to comply. From November 1st, the world's most used web browser will no longer trust digital certificates issued by Intrust, one of the world's most used certificate authorities. How widespread are Intrust digital security certificates? Customers include Chase Bank, Dell, Ernst & Young, MasterCard, and Merrill Lynch, not to mention governments worldwide. The June 27th announcement by Google to revoke certificates issued by Intrust and Affirm Trust, acquired by Intrust in 2016, on the grounds of prioritizing the security and privacy of Chrome's users, stating that we are unwilling to compromise on these values. This is a serious deal, as these certificate authorities act as the foundation of the encrypted connections that users rely between their web browser and the Internet. Google isn't the only browser business to have problems with Intrust. Mozilla has been very vocal in recent months regarding incidents with the certificate authority. Indeed, it was the Firefox browser developer complaints about such incidents between March and May that led to a lengthy and detailed response from Intrust by way of a report to the Mozilla community published on June the 7th. What does this mean to Google Chrome users? While in Trust, an Affirm Trust server authentication certificates that were signed on or before October 31st will continue to be valid until their expiration date, effective November 1, Chrome 127 and later, on Android, Chrome OS, Linux, Mac OS, and Windows platform will cease to be trusted and blocked. Users will see a connection not private dialog when attempting to connect to any site using a blocked certificate, warning that the site could be trying to steal personal or financial information. Google has recommended that website operators should transition to another certificate authority owner as soon as possible, although Google conceded that the impact of blocking certificates could be delayed by operators installing a TLS certificate before the November 1st deadline. It warned that the website operators will inevitably need to collect and install a new TLS certificate from one of the many other certification authorities included in the Chrome Root Store. It should be pointed out that according to Google, users will still be able to manually trust root certificates in order to maintain functionality even after the October 31st cutoff date. Should a Chrome user or enterprise explicitly trust any of the above certificates on a platform and version of Chrome relying on the Chrome Root Store, Google stated, for example, where explicit trust is conveyed through a group policy object on Windows, the constraints will be overridden and certificates will function as they do today. Who is providing the digital certification in your system? CERTMGR.MSC is a Microsoft Management Console, that's MMC, snap-in that allows users to manage certificates, certificate trust list, and certificate revocation list. It is part of the Microsoft Management Console in Windows and provides various tools for managing and maintaining certificates. The MMC contains various tools that can be used for managing and maintenance functions, and Cert Manager, that's CERTMGR.MSC, is one of the snap-ins available within it. CertManager.MSC allows users to view their certificates as well as modify, import, export, delete, or request new ones. It provides the ability to work with both user-specific and system global certificate stores. Additionally, CertManager.MSC can be used to view machine-level certificates, and it also supports the management of test certificates within a certificate store. It is important to note that CertManager.MSC is a Microsoft Management Console snap-in, while CertManager.exe is a command line utility. CertManager.exe is used to manage certificates, CTLs, and CRLs through the command line. Running CertManager.exe without specifying any options launches the CertManager.MSC snap-in, which has a GUI that helps with the certificate management. Users can use CertManager.MSC to manage personal certificates, including importing, exporting, and deleting personal certificates. The Personal System Certificate Store is referred to as, quote, my, comma, unquote, and users can view a list of all certificates in the, quote, capital M, my, unquote, certificate store using, quote, CertManager.exe space minus S space capital M, Y, unquote. You know what? I'll put this on our website so that it's easier to follow. Are my certificates up to date? Based on the information available, it is important to consider the validity periods of digital certificates. Prior to 2015, it was possible to obtain a certificate validity period of up to 5 years. However, this was reduced to 3 years in 2015 and then further reduced to 2 years in 2018. At the end of 2019, a proposal was made to reduce the validity to 1 year. What you need to know about USB ports and speeds. USB-C was supposed to make everything simple. Instead, it's more complicated than ever. The very name, Universal Serial Bus or USB, is an ambitious promise. One port to rule them all. While your phone, tablet, and laptop might all use the same USB-C port for charging and transferring data these days, they can all work differently. What's USB for? What's Thunderbolt? Is it the same as USB-C? Well, first let's define a few terms up front. USB 2.x or USB 3.x or USB 4. Every USB device is built to some versions of the USB specification, managed by the USB Implementers Forum. These versions are mainly characterized by how much data they can transfer and how much power they can deliver. While most of these devices are interoperable as long as they use the same type of port, the entire chain will conform to the slowest part of the chain. Say you plug in a USB 3.2 solid-state drive into a USB 3.2 port on your computer, but use a USB 3.0 cable, data will only transfer at USB 3.0 speeds. So you have to make sure that every link in your chain is rated for the same speed you need, because the speed it takes is the slowest component in the chain. Instead of carrying a charger for every single device you own, you might opt for a charging adapter that can charge up multiple devices via USB power delivery ports. Power delivery is a fast charging method that supports up to 240 watts of power and allows gadgets to safely talk to chargers to sort out the correct power needs. You'll find these kinds of ports on USB hubs sometimes, referred to as pass-through charging, though it's not an official term. Make sure the wattage of a USB-C port on a charging adapter or hub can handle what your device needs. A MacBook Pro typically needs 96 watts during intense workloads, though you can still charge them at lower wattage. So you'll probably need a 100-watt USB-C port on the charging adapter or USB hub for the best charging experience. You get terms like USB-C and USB-A. These terms refer to the physical shape of the connectors and ports on devices. USB-C is common and looks like a small, elongated oval. It's also reversible, so you can't plug it in the wrong way. USB-A is the older rectangular port that you've seen for years. There are a lot more of USB connectors, but these are the two you're most likely to see in charging adapters, hubs, and docking stations. You might also see some USB devices marketed with terms like SuperSpeed, SuperSpeed Plus, SuperSpeed USB 5/10/20 gigabits per second. These terms were initially meant to be more helpful, marketable labels to denote what generation or speed a USB port was, but unfortunately it only made things more confusing. In most cases, it would be nice if you could plug a USB 3.2 device into a USB 3.2 port using a USB 3.2 cable and trust that it all works. Unfortunately, it's way more complicated than that. When USB 3.0 came out in 2008, it had a max speed of around 5 gigabits per second. However, when USB 3.1 came out in 2013 with a max speed of 10 gigabits per second, the 5 gigabits per second version was renamed to USB 3.1 Gen 1, while the new faster spec was USB 3.1 Gen 2. Confused yet? It gets worse. After USB 3.2 came out in 2019, the 5 gigabit per second USB was rebranded again to USB 3.2 Gen 1. The 10 gigabit per second version became USB 3.2 Gen 2, and the new 20 gigabit per second specification became, You guessed it, USB 3.2 Gen 2 times 2, or 2X2. Wait, 2X2, what does that refer to? What it refers to is 2, that's T-W-O, 10 gigabits per second lanes of data simultaneously. You don't need to know all of this. Many USB hub and docking station manufacturers have given up on names, labels, and symbols. They started printing the maximum speed next to ports directly. What this means to you is that if you're using older storage devices or accessories, you may want to look up the specific generation of USB if speed matters to you. A device marketed as USB 3.0 several years ago and a device marketed as USB 3.2 today could potentially have identical transfer speeds if the manufacturer is less than forthcoming with generation names or transfer speed ratings. For what it's worth, we're currently on USB 4 2.0, which was set in 2022, and it can hit up to 80 gigabits per second in data transfer speeds. Thunderbolt is an Intel-owned standard made in collaboration with Apple that uses the same USB-C connector as typical USB devices. However, certain extra requirements have to be met before a device can earn the Thunderbolt label. Higher transfer speeds with the Thunderbolt ports are designed to transfer massive amounts of data compared to the USB-C ports they often sit beside. Thunderbolt 3 and Thunderbolt 4. For example, each speeds up to 40 gigabits per second, while the new Thunderbolt 5 standard reaches a ludicrous 80 gigabits per second, or up to 120 gigabits per second when used for unidirectional connections like outputs to displays. Display output support. Thunderbolt ports are designed to make it easier to connect external displays. Most Thunderbolt ports can at least support up to one 4K display, with more modern versions like Thunderbolt 4 supporting multiple 4K displays. The Thunderbolt 5 is set to expand this even further with support for multiple 8K displays or several 4K displays at super high refresh rates. Compatibility with USB. While Thunderbolt is its own specification, it's still cross-compatible with USB ports. However, any connections will default to the slowest link in the chain. The good news is as long as your device has a USB-C connection, you can plug it into any Thunderbolt port and it will work fine, just maybe a little slower. Getting a USB hub or laptop docking station that's capable of massive data transfer speeds won't matter much if any cables you use aren't capable of those same speeds. This is an easy thing to overlook because most cables don't have labels that tell you what speeds they support. Fortunately, there are a few things you can do to ensure you are using the right cable. Use the cable that came with your device. The simplest way to ensure that a cable is capable of getting the speeds you need is to use the one that comes with any device you have. For example, if you have an external solid-state drive, there's a good chance the USB cable that came with it will support the SSD's fastest speed. Check the box or listing for specs. Some manufacturers will list the version and generation of the USB cable on the box or online listing where you got the cable or the device it came with. Some manufacturers will only list the type of USB connector or only mention the version like USB 3.2 without mentioning the generation like Gen 2 times 2, making it difficult to deduce the actual speed. Look for speeds rather than the USB version. Since USB specs can be confusing, many manufacturers have resorted to listing speeds directly. Are you thoroughly confused now? Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now, and he told me, this is the intro. You've just got to say, you're in the money. And now I'm completely, totally bewildered. You're in the money.
This is about banks.
Banks, okay.
And I want you to remember back in the day when the bank had to be open for you to do anything with them.
I remember those days. Those were nightmare days.
Yeah. Now consider somebody like a Frank Sinatra leaning against a light pole and singing, "It's 2:45. There's no one in the bank. There's just you and me." And he's singing to an ATM machine, one of the early ATM machines.
Okay.
ATM machines in those days,
mm-hmm.
Not the easiest things in the world to use.
I would venture to say even today, there's some struggles. Yes, but go on.
A few, but today's ATM machines have just had, and you may or may not have seen this, another round of upgrades.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So now, for example, when you go to take some cash out, it gives you a choice of what size bills you want and how you want them mixed.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen that.
It's interactive on the screen. You can mm-hmm. pay bills at the keyboard, like you don't have a computer to do it at home. But you can.
Yeah. Now that I haven't seen. Okay.
Yeah. It takes in cash in a couple of different ways, including scanning a check. You can scan check. You can mm-hmm. scan cash. Yeah. You can do a lot of really interesting things. You can choose to have a printed receipt or just have it stored with your account or have it emailed mm-hmm. to you. Yeah. I'm going to email it, but you know how that works. I know. We'll send it to the group address. I always liked the ATM machine as an example of a thing that people broadly came to use mm-hmm. with increasing comfort, despite the fact that no human being was anywhere near it.
Okay.
And more bank robberies happen at ATM machines today than happen at banks today.
I had not thought about that, but it does make sense. Yeah.
And people running trucks into them, all kinds of things.
Sure,
And they might have figured out how much video surveillance there is in and around the machine, but no, I'm not going to tell them.
We'll just say there's cameras. Yes.
There used to be a time when a standard load on an ATM machine, depending on its location, might be $5,000 or $20,000. I'm mm-hmm. not sure where it is today. In fact, if you think about it, we're all using a lot less cash today.
We are. I've distinctly noticed that.
So if you're a manufacturer of ATM machines, what are you looking at? Obsolescence?
Oh, yeah.
How are you going to respond? Now
there is an interesting level of technology where we went along, the human being served as the delivery system for the money. We automated it. It went into the ATM, and now the ATM is going away. Wow.
Well, it's not going away yet.
Well, not fully, but
the challenge is to figure out how to keep it relevant.
What direction would you go in to keep the ATM relevant?
I think we have to increase the variety of services that are there.
Okay.
I think it has to be easy to do things that are not often easy to do at a bank. For example, if the same bank has my mortgage, can I just push a button or a slider to have it transfer money from my checking account to the mortgage account?
Okay. All right.
With the ATM machine, we all have a lot of things that are auto-deposited, like Social Security or paychecks. We all have things that are auto-withdrawn, like Hulu.
Right?
Wouldn't it be nice to have a printout of those? Here's your status pickup since the last time you were here.
That's why my Hulu isn't working. Oh, never mind. Sorry. Okay.
I'm glad I didn't say voodoo.
What are some of the other areas that you would go in with that?
Well, one of the things is that nothing is alone. Mm-hmm. I pointed out many, many decades ago that the computer industry wasn't about that device at the end of your fingers. It was about everything within arm's length, the things in your drawer, your seat, and lighting and everything else.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing for an ATM. One of the first things you may want to do with an ATM is enhance the security around it. and make some of that, not all of it, make some of that visible. One of the things you may want to do is let it give you alerts. If it recognizes your car, and that kind of thing is easy for recognition these days, and it finds that your engine's running warm, it could tell you.
Interesting. I can't remember what the thermal imaging sensors are, but we've talked about that here on the air.
Well, there are many.
That could be done. Yeah. Okay.
Different ways to do that. If you're running a fever, it can tell you that.
Sure.
If you're there, you know, there's no cover on the keyboard as you first drive up to it, but there could be because detecting people is easy. Cover could slide out of the way, and while it's down, UVC could be disinfecting the keys.
Sure.
So, you know, there's no surface contaminants, contagions that are going to reach you through the machine. Inside the machine, if somebody's banging on it, who's it going to report to? You know, let the machine call the cops when it's being robbed.
Not a bad idea. So there's areas to go in. I hadn't thought about improving on the ATM machine, but apparently we can. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell, and that is Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the Chinese typewriter. Meeting time is Thursday, July the 25th. Meeting time start is 6:45 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting. For more information, the website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. The website is acgnj.org. The Tech Ed Connect has something new this coming August. They will have a hybrid meeting Tuesday, August the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. And the hybrid meeting is they have a venue for a general meeting in person. Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York. The zip code is 10583. And they will also have an online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is wpcug.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, August the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Park Plaza Restaurant at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. Happy computing! Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.